And we move from jazz in the 1920s to Ireland in the early 1880s. A powder keg waiting to explode. Famine had begun to grip the country yet again, and farmers were unable to pay exorbitant rents and were being evicted, particularly in the west of Ireland. The Land League was the protector of the tenants, taking on the establishment, and behind the scenes, the secret revolutionary organisation, the IRB, was waiting for its moment to strike. That moment came on the 6th of May, 1882, when an IRB assassination squad, the Invincibles, killed two key political figures involved in British rule in Ireland in the Phoenix Park. And there's a new book about these events. It's called The Invincibles, The Phoenix Park Assassinations and the Conspiracy That Shook an Empire by Dr. Shane Kenna. And to talk about it, I'm joined by two guests. With me in Dublin is historian Micheál O'Divilín, and in our Limerick studio is historian Dr. Ruan O'Donnell, senior lecturer in history at the University of Limerick. You're both very welcome indeed. Now, the reason why we have not have the author of the book in to talk about it is because, sadly, as I'm sure many of our listeners will know, the author of this book, Shane Kenna, passed away 2 years ago. Before we talk about how the book actually came about, Ruan, maybe could you just give us a very brief potted version of the events of the 6th of May, 1882? Who were the victims? Who were the perpetrators?
Well, on that very significant day, two of the most senior administrators of the British Empire in Ireland, Frederick Cavendish, who was the Chief Secretary, and Henry Burke, who was the Undersecretary in Dublin Castle, were accosted by, I suppose, an assassination squad of the Irish National Invincibles, a subgroup of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and knifed to death in broad daylight in what was deemed to be a shocking episode. Cavendish and Burke were the most significant victims, I suppose, of Republican assassins for most of the 19th century, and the country was never the same afterwards.
Now, just in relation, Micheál, to the book itself, both you and Ruan knew Shane, you knew his work, a leading historian of 19th century Ireland, particularly when it came to the Fenians. I mean, the War in the Shadows is a book that I have consulted and read more than once. And he was also a biographer of Jeremiah O'Donovan Rossa and Thomas McDonough. How did this book, though, come to be published? How did it come about? Shane hasn't been with us for about 2 years now.
Well, Shane had a huge interest in the Fenians and, indeed, in the Invincibles. I met him when he was working in Camanum Jail as a guide, still a student at that stage. And he told me so much about them, and his love of them was so obvious. He wrote a book for my publishing company called The Phoenix Park Assassinations, which is a precursor to this, much, much smaller. There's a lot more information and in-depth analysis in this new book. He was interested in them. He researched them. He looked at them. But more importantly, of course, it was the fact that they were buried in Camanum Jail. So he had every day the opportunity to bring people in, show them where they were buried and tell them the story. And this gave him great pleasure to do until he was stopped.
And was this book pretty much finished before he died?
The book, I believe, was complete. It needed to be edited, of course, and that process was never done in his lifetime. It's been done since. And it's a fine job, I have to say. It's a lovely book and a great book and an easy read, again, which is typical of Shane's work.
Yes, very, very easy indeed to read as an historian. Ruan, that was you gave us a great potted version of what actually happened, but talk to us a little bit about the lead up to that, about the tensions of the 1880s, about how, to some extent, the land war spilled over into something entirely different.
Well, you correctly mentioned there was a growing crisis in particularly focused on Connacht from around about 1878. And we have to bear in mind this is a generation who has survived or had just come after on Gorta Mór, the Great Irish Famine, when 1.2 million people at least were put in the ground by with religious services or not. So these are the remnants, these are the survivors, those who have not fled to the cities of the United Kingdom, to Canada, to the United States of America, or Australasia. So the critical thing to understand is the connection between the Irish National Land League, partly founded by an ex-Fenian Michael Davitt, and the revivification of their connections with, I suppose, contemporaneous Irish revolutionaries. Now, this didn't happen overnight, but it involved many inverted commas respected politicians such as Charles Sturt Parnell, John Dillon, the leaders of the Home Rule effort, and what became later the nascent Irish Parliamentary Party. So the critical moment, I think, was the 1st of January 1881, when the British government in Ireland used its then Chief Secretary, William Foster, to introduce a Coercion Act. In other words, to head off this quite successful campaign of focused political violence, mass disobedience, boycotting, resistance to evictions of the poor who were being sent into a position where their lives were threatened by the RIC, the Royal Irish Constabulary. And the decision taken, ironically, and quite interestingly, by one of the facets of this Irish revolution diaspora, that in the United Kingdom. So Frank Byrne, Secretary of the Land League in England, sent a close colleague of his, John Walsh, both of whom were Irish Republican Brotherhood members, back to Dublin to organise a system of resisting government coercion. Now, I could say a great deal about this, but in the interest of radio, I'll keep it very short. The two issues were partly counterintelligence and security. In other words, to preserve those active militant elements of the revolutionary movement from British counterinsurgency. And secondly, and let's be clear about this, was infliction and retaliation with a view to dissuading London from acting in a tyrannical factor in Ireland. So this is the origins of the Irish National Invincibles, a group set up in Dublin at the instigation of John Walsh to guard against British tyranny and to basically hold certain office holders directly, personally accountable. Mm. It's very Fenian indeed.
Yeah, but Micheál, to what extent was it an integral part of the IRB? To what extent was it a splinter group which almost split off from the IRB, or was it somewhere in between?
I think it was somewhere in between. They were drawn from the IRB, drawn from the existing nationalists who were acknowledged. I mean, when you look at how it happened, I mean, Walsh met Ed McCafferty, who then introduced him to James Carey, and he went on then to meet Mullet and then Tony Curley, and then they brought their own people in, but they were all drawing from the same pool. So the maximum 50 people in Dublin who were involved were very close-knit group of people who, in one way or the other, knew other people within the group, and they knew what they were capable of. They were selected as an assassination squad.
Would you compare them to Michael Collins' squad of the War of Independence?
Yes. Not that they had committed murder before, as neither indeed in the case of Collins, but they were people who were expected to be able to follow
orders.
Well,
they tried. They tried to kill W.E. Forster, for example, the Chief Secretary prior to Cavendish.
Oh, they did, but this was after their formation. Mm. They were to follow instructions, follow orders, and to kill people. A difficult thing for anyone to do, so these had to be trusted people. They were selected carefully in order to be able to do this.
Now, the issue of the actual killings themselves, they killed Burke, who was the Undersecretary. They also killed Cavendish, who was the Chief Secretary.
Yeah.
They would have Burke was definitely the target.
Oh, he was the target.
But Cavendish, was that an accident? Did they even know who they had killed?
It was collateral damage. I mean, Burke was a target for two reasons. He was a landlord and a pretty nasty one. Throwing people off his land, etc., but, you know, evictions. He was also, of course, the undersecretary. He was the permanent undersecretary in the Blencastle, and he was a Catholic. And you would expect that he would have had some understanding for the Irish cause, but he had none. And it is alleged that, of course, he was imposing Britain's will with relish. So, but Cavendish had only arrived in the country that day. He'd had two functions. One was where he was actually given his official job, and second, he'd been at a dinner in Dublin Castle, and he was walking to his new home now in the Phoenix Park. He knew Dublin
no
well.
Security.
No security. He knew Dublin well. He'd been here before, but of course in a less prominent position, and it walked around freely. There was also, of course, always the view that if you had security with you, you were admitting something. Mm. So, no. Now, Inspector Mallon, chief of police, had been there in the park earlier on, was warned that something was happening, and was warned to go away by a policeman who said for his own safety.
Away.
He did go away. He said his shoe was hurt.
Yeah.
And he went home. Burke was heading out in a carriage, saw Cavendish, got out, and went walking along with him. And yes, it was purely he happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. That was it.
Rowan, it was a particularly brutal assassination. Most Irish assassinations, and there were assassinations during the Land War, for example, assassinations of landlords and bailiffs, most of them were, they used guns. But this was different. This was knives, and it was a particular kind of knife.
Well, that's quite true. And this is something that caused a great deal of public shock, that cutlery normally used in medical practice were employed and indeed imported by from the UK and purchased for that very purpose. They did knife other people, incidentally, but not with such deliberate, I suppose, intention. It is important to bear in mind that the knives were not procured to kill Cavendish per se. The knives were procured to kill Forster because he was regarded as a tyrant, and also the viceroy himself, Earl Cowper, who had been under significant surveillance, who normally did move with security, hence the great deal of planning that went into the situation. And if I may just digress for one second and come back to the main point, the day before they were killed, two young bandsmen in Ballinar County Mayo had been shot dead by the RIC when they were welcoming home Charles Stuart Parnell, who'd been released just 3 days earlier, the 2nd of May. Arising from that, Foster and Cowper both resigned, removing from the picture two of the three most desirable targets the Invincibles had. So Cavendish was somewhat unfortunate, but I think it must be said, as Chief Secretary, he was regarded by the Invincibles as fair game, as retaliation. Burke, as Micheál absolutely correctly says, was a particular hate figure because he was regarded as an apostate politically and otherwise. The execution of this incident was done with clinical ferocity, and it was clearly showed a great deal of orchestration. Two men in front, others across from the side, and three, at least three from the rear. This is something they have literally rehearsed with a different set of particular targets in mind. And yes, it was shocking. It had the desired effect of reminding the British government that they were not untouchable.
Now, Micheál, what happens after the assassinations? They get away and the investigation begins. And the man you mentioned, Superintendent John Mallon, who would have been in charge of G Division, which was sort of the intelligence unit, if you like, of the Dublin Metropolitan Police, begins an investigation and perhaps investigates more enthusiastically than he, well, certainly with more enthusiasm than he was, than he exhibited on the day, on the 6th of May, 1882, for sticking around and seeing what was going to happen.
Yeah, well, you know, you've got to understand how policing worked at the time, particularly detection. It was based primarily on informers. So he went looking for his informers. He found difficulty in getting them, but he very quickly found out who was alleged to have done this. He arrested, maybe 30 people ultimately. They were brought to Kilmainham Jail. They were tried. There were mistrials. There were people being released. There was a lot of trickery going on in the jail, where, unable to break them, he pretended that one was informing by setting up an empty cell opposite to Curley. Setting up an empty cell across from him and having people going in and out with notebooks.
Because he was convinced Curley was involved, but he couldn't prove it. And then he hoodwinked Curley into
Curley broke. And of course, as usual, once one goes, others will follow.
Sorry, Carey, I beg your pardon. Yeah. Carey was the one who broke. Yeah. James Carey was the one who broke, thinking that Curley was basically shopping them all.
Yeah.
And Carey then turns up as a state witness and was crucial in all of this, wasn't he?
Yes, he was indeed. He was vital, and of course, he was ostracised by the others. They laughed at him, they threatened him, they did, you know. But yes, he was. But there was more than that. There was a young girl, his name escapes me at the moment, from Drogheda, whom Mallon offered a bribe to. Her fiancé was in jail, and he said he would have him released if she gave certain information, which was false. She refused to do that. She came forward later and announced this. But this was how detection worked. Mm. It was a crooked business at the time, and it was probably on the basis of fighting fire with fire. You know, a lot of these political societies that were relying equally on informers on the inside information coming out. They were so it was a case of having to, well, from their point of view, having to fight fire with fire.
And I think, Rowan, for many, many years afterwards, Kerry would have been to the south of Ireland what Lundy would be to unionists in the north of Ireland, would he not?
No, that's a fair point. And part of the poignancy of Kerry's fate having been manipulated by an incredibly able and slightly strange Inspector Mallon was that he had been one of the most significant centres, in other words, mid-level leaders of Fenians in Dublin. Yeah. He was a very well-known man. He was a public figure. He would have been highly regarded. And the fact that himself and his brother and Miles Kavanagh found themselves manipulated into the worst thing of all, which is giving evidence against former comrades, it was something that shocked people. So when he was assassinated en route to what he hoped would be, I'm sure, an anonymous exile in southern Africa, and accosted by Pat O'Donnell and done to death, Pat O'Donnell emerges from this whole period as probably the single most lamented figure. Even more so than Joe Brady, even more so than Dan Curley, is Pat O'Donnell's prowess in taking out a man at an opportune moment, at almost certain risk of going to the gallows himself, which indeed occurred. He became one of the few martyrs of this rather shocking episode.
Now, what about the involvement or non-involvement or the accusations or allegations of involvement or sympathy or complicity or whatever way you want to put it, of one Charles Stewart Parnell in all of this, Ruan?
Well, that's a terrific question, and you could have a whole show on that one.
You could. Miles,
and hope you will someday. But if you take it back, just very briefly, to as far back as 1877, Parnell was in direct contact with leaders of the Irish Republican Brotherhood and Clan na Gael, the Irish-American annex, with a strong base in New York City and also Philadelphia, with John O'Leary, with J.J. Kelly, and even the great John Devoy, the New York City-based titan, who would later become the mentor of Tom Clark. This led to the so-called New Departure, which was an agreement between elements of militant republicanism that there might be ways of advancing the interests of Ireland short of a dynamite campaign, whereas others were advocating precisely such, not least Jeremiah Donovan Rossa, the Brooklyn Dynamite School, and all of that. So Parnell was in touch with the upper leadership of the tendency from which the Irish National Invincibles emerged. It became the role of other British agents, particularly when Home Rule looked like being potentially successful in the rule of Gladstone, the fairly progressive and liberal English Prime Minister, British Prime Minister, of Richard Pigott and the Fenian spy Henry Le Caron, a.k.a. Thomas Beach, to connect Parnell to the killers. Now, Parnell had spoken in Parliament famously, sympathetically, about the Manchester Martyrs of 1867, who had also been killed in an attempt to rescue prisoners, and, you know, there's loss of life. Sergeant Brett was killed in that episode. Parnell had been associated as someone who had dealt in his earliest careers with Patrick Egan, John Martin, and others as associated with not just Young Ireland, but also the 1867 era IRB. Allegedly, and probably, Parnell had joined the IRB around about May-ish of 1882, around the time of the so-called Comenham Treaty, when he was negotiating tentative terms with the Gladstone government. Parnell was, of course, obliged to distance himself from what happened at the Phoenix Park. There's no suggestion of direct agency. To my mind, the Invincibles were people who wanted to push that particular envelope much further than someone like Parnell would ever do into an independent secular Irish Republic, as declared by the Fenian Brotherhood in 1867, a reiteration of Robert Emmet's proclamation in 1803.
Finally, Micheál, the Invincibles, as you said, they were hanged in Kilmainham Jail. They were buried more or less where they were hanged, and their bodies are still there. There is some talk that the bodies might be transferred to Glasnevin Cemetery.
Well, I sit on a committee at the moment that is attempting to get them removed. I mean, they are there illegally. The jail is closed, so the sentence was completed in 1910 when that ceased to be a jail. And they're being held there. They're not even part of the tour, really, usually. So they're lying idle, lying there, ignored. These, love them or hate them, they deserve not to be ignored. Glasnevin have said they would gladly take the bodies and bury them there. So we're agitating now to have them removed and placed in a grave in Glasnevin.
Ruan O'Donnell and Micheál O'Devlin, thank you both very much indeed for joining us this evening on The History Show. The book is The Invincibles, The Phoenix Park Assassinations and the Conspiracy That Shook an Empire. It's published by O'Brien Press, written by the late Dr. Shane Kenna, sadly, as I say, no longer with us, who has definitely left a huge legacy, a valuable legacy in the field of 19th century Irish political history.